Welcome to Thursday's Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. Could oil field wastewater become North Dakota's and the nation's next source of lithium? And how did a state law promoting critical minerals end up listing minerals that don't exist? North Dakota Monitor reporter Jacob Orledge will join us for another closer look with the Monitor. Then on Tech with Peck, what does a home theater really mean and how can you upgrade picture and sound without overspending? Plus a programming note, tonight at 8 p.m. on the television service of Prairie Public, CEO John Harris sits down with Governor Kelly Armstrong for the season premiere of Prairie Pulse. You can watch it on Prairie Public or stream it on the PBS app and YouTube. This is Main Street on Prairie Public, and this is a closer look with the Monitor. I'm Craig Blumenschein. Today, we're looking beyond barrels of oil to the next frontier, maybe, in North Dakota's energy economy. Could the water that comes up with oil, long considered a nuisance or a waste, become the source of lithium used in electric vehicle batteries and other advanced technologies? And what does it say about the state's push into rare earths and critical minerals that its defining law ended up listing fictional elements? Our guest today is Jacob Orledge with the North Dakota Monitor. He reports on energy and environmental topics for the Monitor. We'll explore both the promise and the pitfalls, perhaps, of North Dakota's expanding role in the critical minerals supply chain. Jacob, welcome back to Main Street.
Thanks for having me on again, Craig.
Jacob, will you set the stage for us on exactly what lithium is? We've all heard it maybe going through the TSA line. Do you have any lithium batteries? And people just kind of blink at that a little bit and say, you know, probably not or whatever. But give us the lowdown on what lithium is and why it's a critical mineral.
So lithium, as you said, is considered a critical mineral. And critical minerals are basically a list of 60 different minerals released by the federal government, by the Department of the Interior. And these minerals are considered vital to the U.S. economy or national security. Lithium in particular is used in rechargeable batteries. So if you own a smartphone, if you own a laptop, if you use an electric car, all of these things require lithium. Without lithium, you do not have a smartphone.
So now we turn to oil field wastewater. What's the basic idea behind using that produced water, as it's called, as a source of lithium?
So in order to understand the idea of extracting lithium from produced water, you first need to understand what produced water is. It's basically an inevitable byproduct of crude oil production. When oil and gas comes out of the ground in North Dakota, water comes up with it. This is naturally occurring water. It's not the drinking water you think of underground. This is something different. And this water comes up. It's called produced water. It's very, very saline. It's very salt intensive. And ordinarily, this water is separated from the oil and gas. It's piped from a network of oil and gas wells to a central disposal site called saltwater disposal wells. And then this produced water is re-injected underground for permanent storage. Now, the idea behind the latest proposal to extract lithium from this produced water is that this produced water will often contain other minerals. In this case, we're talking about lithium, although the company we're going to talk about in a minute is also looking at the possibility of extracting other minerals like magnesium from this water. And the idea is to basically build a treatment plant on the same site as the saltwater disposal wells, but before the produced water is re-injected underground, it'll go through this treatment process. Certain valuable minerals like lithium will be extracted, and then it'll just go to the saltwater disposal well where it was headed in the first place.
So there's this one company that you're aware of called Lithium Harvest, who has spoken at a conference you attended. What do they want to do?
Yeah, so I attended the Emerging Industries Conference hosted by the Northwest Landowners Association here in Bismarck earlier this week. And Lithium Harvest was a co-founder of Lithium Harvest was one of the speakers there. They have plans, and they are deep in the development of two facilities in North Dakota to basically do what I just explained. These facilities will be co-located on saltwater disposal well sites, and they will be extracting lithium in economic quantities from that produced water before it's re-injected underground. Further details on these projects are a little thin on the ground at the moment. What we do know is Lithium Harvest has partnered with an unnamed oil and gas operator to make these happen. The only detail they would provide is that the oil and gas operator is a quote-unquote big producer in the state. Lithium Harvest expects these facilities to be operational sometime in 2027. So we're talking within the next 2 years. And that's really what sets these facilities and Lithium Harvest technology apart from traditional lithium mining, which can take years and years and be very capital intensive in the cost it takes to set up operations. Whereas Lithium Harvest is saying that they're going to be able to develop these projects in under 2 years, and they're going to be able to construct it at a far lesser cost than traditional methods.
Did they mention whether they also have some regulatory hurdles they need to get across, Jacob, or some other permitting that's required? Or is this something that can go forward pretty much fast track like you were describing?
So I'm not sure if I would describe it as fast tracked or not. They certainly claim to be able to do it faster than traditional mining methods. But from what Lithium Harvest was saying on Monday, their permitting process goes through the North Dakota Industrial Commission, which regulates oil and gas in the state, and it is considered a wastewater or treatment facility, is what the Lithium Harvest representative was saying. They said they've had those conversations with the Industrial Commission, although there is not clarity at this moment whether that permitting process has been completed or not. That is one of the things that I plan to look into moving forward.
You've also reported on a story that's really a head scratcher to me. A law that was supposed to define critical minerals mistakenly included fake minerals. How did that happen and what happened?
Well, the short answer to that, Craig, is nobody knows for sure. But here's what we do know. A North Dakota law was passed by the state legislature in 2025. This law modified existing coal leases to include critical minerals and rare earth elements in the definition of coal, giving companies with a coal lease the legal authority to extract those additional minerals that are sometimes found in lignite coal seams here in North Dakota. Just a little bit of background there. The list of critical minerals that was included in the law included two minerals, freesium and strelium, which don't actually exist. And this didn't come to light immediately. It didn't come to light until November or December at a North Dakota Industrial Commission meeting where Agriculture Commissioner Doug Goring, who describes himself as a chemistry geek, brought this question up. Because he did not recognize those two names. So he asked the state geologist, Ed Murphy, what those were, because he wasn't familiar with them. And the response from Ed Murphy was that it was essentially an inside joke in the legislature. But that's only half the story. So I did a little bit more digging, myself and the monitor team, and we discovered a few additional details. So essentially, these two minerals that don't exist were added to the bill very late in the process. It was the last day of the legislative session. The bill in question was in the conference committee, where differences between two versions of the bill, one passed by the Senate, one passed by the House, both sides basically appoint a joint committee that come together and try to resolve any differences there. They appointed an unofficial subcommittee that was meeting off the books and was assigned or was directed to come up with amendments to this bill to make it satisfactory for everyone. The amendments that came out of this unofficial committee was the first instance of these two fake minerals appearing in the legislative record that I can discover. Nobody knows who added them, why they were added, or how. The legislator for whom those amendments was officially prepared is Representative Dick Anderson. His name is on that set of amendments where those minerals first appeared. But when I interviewed Representative Anderson, he said that he was not involved in that unofficial committee, but he was simply the prime sponsor of the bill. He was the main driver of this idea, so his name was attached to that final set of amendments. Legislative counsel, when I spoke to them, these are the nonpartisan staffers that work behind the scenes and help draft the actual text of a bill or amendments at the direction of legislators. They said they're understandably not experts in critical minerals or rare earth elements. And while they do fact checking earlier in the process to make sure all the T's are crossed and all the I's are dotted, this was the last day of session. It was hours before the legislature was ultimately going to dismiss themselves. Apparently these fake minerals were not caught in time. And the last thing I'll throw out there is the coincidence that the names of the fake minerals bear a striking resemblance to the names of two attorneys who work for a coal company who were involved in the drafting of this bill. These are David Straley and Christopher Fries. I spoke to David Straley after this came out at the Industrial Commission meeting. He said that they were not responsible for adding these minerals. He agrees that the minerals were clearly named after himself and his colleague. And he speculated that they were added to either as a joke or as a way to make light of the bill or even to embarrass himself and his colleague. But he emphasized that they were not personally responsible for adding this. And as far as anybody knows, they just magically appeared in the bill. Nobody has admitted to adding these fake minerals to a list of real and very important minerals that were in the bill.
I'm sure it's something that can be cleaned up. When I first heard of this, I thought, okay, AI just hallucinated these particular minerals and threw them out there in somebody's query and cut and paste, and here we go. But boy, there's maybe a little more to it. So thanks for that, Jacob.
Well, I'll just jump in here on the AI thing, and I'll just say why that doesn't pass muster for me, because these were added very late in the process. Mm-hmm. This wasn't at the very beginning of the process. It wasn't like somebody just asked for a list of critical minerals while they were writing the bill or anything like that. That's very clearly not what happened. This was the last day of the legislative session, not the first day. And it was just these two minerals that were being added right to an already existing list in a definition. So while it might be tempting to blame AI for everything that happens, I don't think the facts support that in this specific circumstance.
Joining my conversation with Jacob Orlidge, this is our weekly discussion with reporters from the North Dakota Monitor. We call it A Closer Look with the Monitor. Today, we're talking about lithium and other critical minerals. Jacob, I want to broaden out our discussion just a little bit. How significant do you think these processes that we spoke about earlier to perhaps, I guess, mine lithium from spent water from oil wells, how significant of a process do you think this might be for the state? Are there jobs? Is there investment? Does this help the state diversify its economy?
I think it's a little too soon to say definitively how large of an economic impact this will have. I think it's certainly going to be a new industry for the state of North Dakota. How much it will contribute to economic diversification, I really can't say yet. But the proponents of these technologies, of these emerging industries, certainly believe that it is going to be a big deal. It's been pointed out to me that North Dakota could be a big part of a solution to a big problem nationally, internationally, as a source for some of these critical minerals and rare earth elements. And just a quick primer on what those are. We covered earlier that critical minerals are a list of 60 minerals considered vital to the U.S. by the federal government. those are sometimes used interchangeably with the term rare earth elements, but that's actually a separate grouping. Rare earth elements are considered critical minerals, but not all critical minerals are rare earth elements. Essentially, the difference is the latter. The rare earth elements are naturally occurring elements that are not actually all that rare. It is simply rare to find them in nature in quantities, in concentrations that are economically viable to extract or produce. So that's your primer on what rare earth elements and critical minerals are. I can say that I spoke to one landowner this week in the western half of the state who is looking at this. I spoke to one landowner in the western part of the state who believes that this is an opportunity for landowners to get in on the ground floor of an emerging industry. He observes the way his forefathers, that previous generations, approached oil and gas development in his area of the state. And he sees this as an opportunity to get in on the ground floor of a new industry and not make some of the mistakes that his previous generations would have tried to avoid in hindsight.
There's a lot of conversation about energy demand. We've all heard big data centers, big industrial loads. So how does this tie into the narrative around using more of North Dakota's own energy for new industry? Are they related here?
I think they are somewhat. This was another topic that came up at that conference earlier this week by the Northwest Landowners Association. I will say this. There was a speaker there, Tom Oakland. He's with the North Dakota Department of Commerce. He pointed out that one of the reasons a lot of these large load customers are looking at North Dakota is because we have such abundant natural gas production here in the state. And according to statistics he presented during his presentation, North Dakota only consumes about 15% of the natural gas it produces. The remaining 85% is exported out of state. And in his view, that creates an incredible economic opportunity for additional power generation to be located here in North Dakota to fuel industries like data centers, like other manufacturing. There is a caveat here. So the next speaker following on Tom Oakland's heels was a vice president from Basin Electric Power Cooperative, which oversees a lot of the power generation here in North Dakota. He was saying that it is already a big task to keep up with the power generation demands of North Dakota's existing population. While we might have lower electricity prices compared to the rest of the country, that does not mean that we necessarily have excess power generation. There's a fundamental difference between having the natural gas available to power power plants and having the power plants available, built, constructed, and ready to use that natural gas. The peak power demand in North Dakota occurred in January 2025 in Basin Electric's area, and that was roughly 5 gigawatts of power demand. Basin Electric has enough power generation capacity to meet that. They don't have enough power generation to meet that 5 gigawatts and meet the 10 gigawatts of interest that has been expressed by what they call large load customers.
Data centers, perhaps.
That would be a category of customers who are expressing interest, I assume.
For listeners who want to follow this, Jacob, energy or other economic development relative to these projects, what should they be watching for on, I guess, both of these fronts? The lithium story that you've written about, the lithium from oil water story. What should we watch for moving forward?
I think we are all going to be watching to see how all of this plays out. One thing to keep an eye on is potential litigation moving forward. We touched on House Bill 1459, which is the bill that includes two fictional minerals. That bill, or that law now, is very likely to be the subject of litigation moving forward. The fake minerals will likely not be the subject of litigation. Mm. That is something that legislators can clean up.
Why the thought of potential litigation, Jacob?
The potential litigation is likely to be initiated by landowners in the state. So House Bill 1459, aside from including fictional minerals, was the subject of significant controversy during the legislative session. As we mentioned earlier, this bill essentially redefines coal leases to also include critical minerals and rare earth elements. A lot of landowners that I've spoken to and heard from believe that essentially illegally modifies existing contracts that do not mention those terms or those minerals. And this law also sets a royalty rate in state law for production of these minerals, where the owners of the coal who have leased that in prior generations to the coal companies are now going to receive a royalty based on critical mineral production, but they had no role in negotiating that part of the lease, no role in negotiating that royalty rate. Now, there is a bit of a dichotomy here, or pros and cons, because the coal industry and many legislators will argue this bill was necessary to provide certainty to an uncertain industry in the hopes of growing North Dakota's economy and helping North Dakota's coal industry while also providing a domestic supply of critical minerals. But landowners feel that the state, this was a bit of a state overreach. And litigation, I won't say litigation is certain to occur, but I've heard from landowner groups, and it certainly seems like litigation is a likely possibility on that bill moving forward.
Finally, Jacob, is there any tension that you recognize between environmentalists, or those who have expressed environmental concerns, and the economic opportunity that apparently is there with these developments? Have you heard anything about that?
I think there's certainly going to be environmental concerns with any new industry, but the larger conflict that I have been paying attention to has been between economic development and property rights. And there are a lot of nuances here. We could do an entire Main Street segment on that alone, Craig. But I'll leave the listeners with this, that there seems to be a conflict playing out over a variety of issues where one group of people is focused more on economic development, while another group of people is focused more on protecting the principles of property rights that they feel are being infringed upon. And there's still some tension there that needs to be resolved in North Dakota moving forward.
And that's A Closer Look with the Monitor. I'm Craig Blumenschein from Prairie Public. It's been my pleasure to host Jacob Orledge. He's a North Dakota Monitor reporter, and his assistance for helping us untangle the intersection of energy policy and economic change is welcome. North Dakota may be best known for oil, but as his stories and his reporting has shown, the state also is navigating how to turn byproducts into high-tech materials and how to craft policy around minerals that matter, not just here in North Dakota, but globally. So we'll keep an eye on how these developments unfold and what they'll mean for communities, landowners, and the broader energy landscape. You can read all of Jacob's and his colleagues' great reporting without a paywall, without subscriptions, at NorthDakotaMonitor.com. Jacob, it's always a pleasure. Thank you.
Thanks for having me on, Craig.
A Closer Look at the Monitor continues. We now bring in Amy Dalrymple. She's the editor-in-chief of the North Dakota Monitor, North Dakota State's newsroom outlet, and she joins us periodically on A Closer Look with the Monitor to share what she and her team are working on and to highlight perhaps some of the stories readers should be watching for at the Monitor. Of course, you can read the Monitor at any time, free from paywalls or subscriptions, at NorthDakotaMonitor.com. Amy, welcome back to Main Street, and let us know, what else is the North Dakota Monitor working on?
Hi, Craig. Happy to be here. One story that we published this week that has attracted a lot of attention is a story about some early retirement incentives that are being offered to state employees. This is a voluntary program that the state is rolling out in response to state revenues that are declining, primarily related to a drop in oil tax revenue. The state is also projecting a drop in sales tax and income tax revenue.
What's interesting to me about this rollout is that it's really happening fairly early, right? Well in front of another budget session, another session of the North Dakota legislature. So what do we know about the incentives, Amy? What have you learned?
Yeah, you're right that we typically won't see a proposed budget until December. But what happens behind the scenes is that agencies will be building their budgets really starting in April. And so that's why they announced this program at this time. And so what we know so far is that the state agencies were notified this week about the early retirement program. And for those agencies that decide to opt in, the employees are expected to be notified next week about the incentive. And what's being offered is for 3 months of salary and health benefits.
So what do we know about the state and its future pocketbook deficit? What's ahead?
Sure. And so, I mean, I think it's probably cause for concern anytime you hear about a program like this. It is similar to some voluntary buyouts that were offered to state employees under Governor Doug Burgum in 2017 and 2018. So I think it's important to keep in mind that this does not mean that the state is projecting a budget shortfall or that anyone is expecting across the board budget cuts. But we've sort of become accustomed to these large surpluses at the end of budget cycles. And right now what's being projected for those balances in June 2027 is a much smaller amount of money that lawmakers will have to work with in the next budget.
All right, let's turn the pages in the newspaper, which is the metaphor I use for the monitor. It's kind of become that for me, for sure. What other stories are attracting interest?
Sure. Well, the North Dakota Monitor is part of a national network. And one thing that we like to highlight in our newsletter is some states from some stories from neighboring states that might be of interest to North Dakota readers. Right now, with South Dakota and Iowa having legislative sessions, there have been some interesting stories that relate to carbon dioxide pipelines that I think are of interest to North Dakota readers. In Iowa this week, there are discussions about taxing CO2 that is transported by pipeline. And in South Dakota, lawmakers are again discussing issues related to eminent domain and property rights.
So, I mean, how can we subscribe to the newsletter?
Yeah, you can subscribe for free just by going to North Dakota Monitor to subscribe.
That's today's update from A Closer Look with the Monitor. Our thanks to Amy Dalrymple and Jacob Orledge for sharing not only current stories, but what's ahead for the North Dakota Monitor. And of course, you can find new episodes of this podcast, A Closer Look with the Monitor, and follow along every Thursday on Main Street and every Friday at NorthDakotaMonitor.com or wherever you get your podcasts. Amy, it's always wonderful to visit with you. Here's to another great week next week.
All right. Thanks, Craig.
Still to come on Main Street, Tech with Peck. We'll begin what will become a multi-part discussion on home theater. What is it you want in yours? That's ahead. Stay with us. This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein, and today on Tech with Peck, we're tackling a phrase a lot of us use without always meaning the same thing, and that's home theater. For some people, that means a wall-sized screen and a booming surround sound. That's kind of like yours, George. We'll get to that later. But for others, it's just wanting movies and sports to look and sound better in the living room without spending a fortune. George, welcome back to Main Street.
Thank you.
George, when people say they want a home theater, to you, what does that usually mean?
What really is home theater? And that's a really good question. I guess it depends on our listener considers that to be. So I'll just start with my particular opinion or kind of take, and that the term itself, home theater, the theater part means it is somewhat reminiscent of a cinema that you go to and sit in a nice chair with a bunch of other people and watch on a big screen and hear in various forms of sound and eat expensive popcorn and drink expensive drinks. And so it's kind of that experience. And so what part of that experience do you want to bring into your home, and what do you consider that, you know, how much of that experience do you consider to be required for home theater? So I guess it's very, very, very subjective.
We have a television upstairs that we watch sports on, we watch some movies on, but then we have the place we kind of retreat to downstairs to get a little better sound, to get a little bigger screen, little darker, nicer environment. And I, for some folks, that's maybe the difference in where are we going to do this? What are we going to do it for? When are we going to do it? Only when it's 20 below and we're going to be outside in the summertime and all this kind of stuff.
The first thing I'm going to say is you have a different temperature threshold than I do.
just winter,
remember
George.
Where we are.
You're in Colorado. I'm in North Dakota here.
Let me kind of give you again a little overview of my home. So in my family room, I have what I would imagine many people would consider a home theater-ish television. It's an 83-inch OLED, so a high-quality television. And I have a 7-channel Dolby Atmos system that I've kind of, it's a kind of a piecemeal together system, but I've got 2 front speakers with built-in subs and 2 height speakers and 2 rear speakers and a center channel speaker in the family room. I don't consider that home theater simply because I still don't think a television qualifies as home theater. It's just a personal opinion. Now, downstairs, I have an unfinished basement, so maybe you can't have home theater in an unfinished basement. But I did curtain it off with velvet, black velvet curtains, so it's sound deadened. It's dark all day, every day, 20 below or otherwise. And I've got a 120-inch screen with a projector. And to me, at least personally, my home theater experience requires front projection because I have yet to go into a cinema, an AMC OLED 10, where there's 10 OLED screens in the front of the room. It's still front projection. So that's, for me personally, a key definition of home theater. Now, I've seen people that have, and you can now purchase 110-inch and greater televisions if you got a lot of money. And you can pop it in the front of the room and you've got as big of a screen as I might. And it's just, but I still, it's a television. It's not a theater. It's just a personal definition. What brings you the pleasure? What gives you that same feeling that you know, or as much of it as you can get from being in that cinema experience? It's up to you.
And I think that is the grand way to look at this overview we're providing tonight before we get into the details in following weeks. But what is it you want to get from your experience? And George, do you also go down to watch sports in your home theater, or do you go downstairs to watch the sitcom, or do you just use it for great movies?
See, that's a great question because I am somewhat of a fan of old television shows. And so we'll watch, I'm going to date myself.
We're watching you
every night now just to kind of, relax. You remember Emergency from like 1974?
Squad 51, George.
Squad 51.
Let's see. Randolph Mantooth.
Randolph
Mantooth.
Kevin Tye. So here's did you see, it's very possibly the best picture this year. What after another?
I haven't seen it yet. No.
All right. Well, I can't remember the name of it. But Kevin Tye, who played Roy DeSoto in Emergency, has a role in this film.
I don't feel so old now.
So in any event, that is an old standard definition, not restored, bad film from 1970 television show. And we watch it occasionally in our theater.
Nice.
We usually will watch it on a television, but sometimes we go downstairs. But what we generally reserve the quote-unquote theater for is Sinners or F1 or Dune in 3D, by the way, which our theater is capable of. So the more grandiose, more real theater experiences are what we generally reserve that for, with occasional exceptions.
How about the rectangular or squarish space of a room? To me, the room needs to be more rectangular than square. And I think oftentimes a living room may not allow for that. And so you really can't get that, to me, the theater experience, if you're kind of watching things at such an angle and instead of really straight on.
What's comfortable? I mean, it may be comfortable. And I've seen, there's a guy on YouTube I follow. And by the way, if you want to follow some great home theater, his name is Youth Man. That's his tag on YouTube. And he tours everything from, he probably wouldn't tour mine. Mine's not high-end enough for him. But he has toured some very high-end home theaters that have sectionals, couches, and love seats in them. Mm-hmm. So it's not unheard of. And depending on the room and where sure. the screen is and where the audio is placed, you can have a very, you know, pleasant experience. But again, I like to sit right in the middle of the room in a comfortable theater seat, facing that screen straight forward, being in the middle of the sound field as much as I can.
That's important. We're going to talk about sound later, and that's a big deal what you're talking yeah. about right there, I think. And George, as we kind of look forward, a budget here, a minimum budget to maybe certainly the maximum can be about whatever you want to spend. For what you've talked about tonight, kind of a minimum budget threshold people ought to be thinking about.
So to give you an idea, the television is the thing that's going to be probably the most considerate from dollar perspective.
Or a projector, right?
Well, I mean, I'm saying, yeah. So the video source, be a projector or a television. Now, sound can get very expensive and very involved. In my dedicated theater, I have all originally purchased matched components. For the most part, I got a Rogue subwoofer there, but it fits pretty nicely. Now, in my family room, I have a pair of speakers that I got 25 years ago as my rears. I have the same manufacturer, but completely different model front speakers, different manufacturer front height speakers, smaller, and then a center channel speaker that's the same manufacturer, but yet a different model than all the rest. So I piecemealed that together. And you can piecemeal things together. You can buy something, go to Facebook Marketplace or Craigslist and buy something used. So depending on, you know, what compromises you're willing to make, you can create a quote unquote home theater for a couple $1,000s. Yep. You can, and then the sky's the limit the other way around. So it just depends on what your budget is, how much you want to spend, how much compromise you're willing to make on quality of video, quality of sound. To a great extent, it's determined by what your definition of a home theater is.
George, we're out of time today.
Okay, one more thing. One battle after another. I just thought of the name.
Okay. That's George Peck. He'll help us demystify what home theater really means. He's helped us start there today. We're going to talk about projectors in our next conversation next week. We're going to get into the details about the different types of projectors that are available. And we will develop over time a short series of just what home theater is and maybe what it's not as we visit with George on Thursdays here on Tech with Peck. George, it's a pleasure.
It's fun. Looking forward to next week, man.
The Empire Theater Company in Grand Forks presents a new comedy for adults, The Nut Lab, by Kathy Kudell King, February 12th through the 21st. The play follows strangers in a nutrition study, each with personal motives and quirks, alongside the staff who oversee them. More information at EmpireArtCenter.com.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein, and we're checking in again. It's Thursday with the North Dakota Gateway to Science. Pleased to be joined by Hope Rudolski. She is the STEM education specialist there. Hope, welcome back to Main Street.
Thank you for having me.
All right. Valentine's Day is upon us. We can yes. kind of have a science twist now with Valentine's Day through the Gateway to Science. Tell me more.
Yes. So what we are focusing on today is something that you can do right at home with materials that are relatively easy to find. I'm actually doing one for my significant other, but we are creating LED cards for Valentine's Day. And so with this LED card, all you need is some cardstock or construction paper, whatever you have, some markers so you can decorate it, copper tape, or some tape or even pipe cleaners that would work, something that is conductive and so electricity can run through it, as well as an LED bulb and a coin battery. And so with our LED cards, you are able to decorate it however you want and then decide where you want your LED to go. And so this LED bulb has two prongs on it, and these prongs are going to go on the two sides of the coin battery. And as you add the battery to the bulb, it'll start to light up. And so something that I'm doing is I'm writing, "You light up my world," and then I'm putting my LED bulb right at the end just to give a little bit of extra fun to it.
So where can we find the supplies to do this?
With these supplies, usually you can find them in a grocery store. You can find them at any store, usually in your town. I would say also Target, Walmart, Amazon. But really, if you can find a coin battery, a pipe cleaner, and some cardstock, you are in good shape.
I'm watching Hope now in our interview. I'm able to see her. She's got a big bandage on her finger. You didn't shock yourself making the LED card, did you?
No, I actually, it happened while I was doing outreach at a school, and oh, no. I got into a fight with our utility cart, but we're good.
The North Dakota Gateway to Science. We check in every Thursday. A nice Valentine's Day project Hope's outlined for us, and it's again a good way to work with kiddos and do something special for maybe someone important in their lives or someone important in your life. Hope, thanks for joining us on Main Street.
Thank you for having me.
The Fargo-Moorhead Symphony presents A Night at the Oscars, February 21st at the Fargo Theater. Conducted by Jane Lind Capistran, the program features the FM Choral Artist with music from Oscar-winning films. Information at fmsymphony.org.
Here's Chuck Lura with Natural North Dakota.
A friend of mine recently mentioned that a flock of crows were raising a ruckus outside his home in North Fargo. When the crows are in a tizzy, it often means that they found an owl to harass. Sure enough, when he went to check it out, the object of the mobbing was a barred owl. Crows make it abundantly clear that owls are not to be tolerated. And they'll mob other potential predators as well, including hawks, eagles, and cats. Mobbing's the behavior used to drive a predator away, protect young, maybe steal some food, or perhaps to sound the alarm to other birds and animals that a predator is in the area. Barred owls are a species of the forest in wooded areas, often near water where they feed on mice, voles, small birds, and such. Range maps often show that barred owls are permanent residents over much of southern Canada and in the United States east of a line from Minnesota southward, plus portions of the Pacific Northwest and California. So the Red River Valley is on the edge of their range. Robert Stewart, in his Breeding Birds of North Dakota from 1975, noted that there were no records of nests or dependent young in North Dakota, but they were likely nesting in the state, particularly along the Cheyenne River in Richland and Ransom County. A quick check of eBird, eBird.org, revealed a recent sighting of a barred owl in Fargo's Oak Grove area. Most sightings in the state are in the Red River Valley, particularly in the Fargo and Grand Forks areas. Barred owls are cavity nesters, and they're known to maintain their territories year-round. As such, there's a good chance they are nesting in the area. Barred owls are a little smaller than great horned owls. Their common name is a reference to the light and dark barring of the feathers, particularly on the throat and upper chest. There are also stripes on the lower parts of the body. Two other characteristics that help in identification are that barred owls lack the ear tufts or horns of, for example, great horned owls, and have dark eyes rather than yellow eyes like many other owls. Most everyone is familiar with the low-toned hoo, hoo, hoo call of the great horned owl. The call of the barred owl is a little higher pitched, who cooks for you? I've put links to more information on this interesting bird, including recordings of their calls, along with the text of this Natural North Dakota. You can access them at prairiepublic.org. I'm Chuck Lura.
Natural North Dakota is supported in part by the NDSU Central Grasslands Research Extension Center. You can get Natural North Dakota essays delivered to your inbox every week. Sign up for the email newsletter at prairiepublic.org.
This is Bird Note. Even if you had feathers, lightweight bones, and powerful wings, you would still lack something essential to flying like a bird: the highly efficient breathing anatomy that powers the exertion of flight. The human apparatus of diaphragm and lungs is just not up to the job. It can't extract enough oxygen to fuel flight. A bird's breathing anatomy is far more efficient than ours. It is driven by large, thin-walled air sacs located throughout the body cavity. The air sacs operate like bellows, first storing and then directing air to create a one-way flow through the bird's lungs. This parabronchial system for extracting oxygen from the air has a far greater surface area than the lungs of a mammal, making sustained flight possible. And birds lack a diaphragm. Instead, they inhale and exhale using special muscles that expand or contract the entire body cavity and air sacs. The way they breathe allows migrating birds to fly in the thin air thousands of feet above the Earth, a feat we can only marvel at from below. For Bird Note, I'm Michael Stein.
This is Dakota Datebook for February 5th. While many immigrants settled in the East, the Homestead Act enticed a large percentage to the Great Plains and unfamiliar land that had, until then, been under tribal control. The land they were able to claim was many times larger than the small farms they had in their home countries. Immigrants were crucial to the settlement of the Great Plains in general, and North Dakota in particular. In 1870, 34% of the settlers in Dakota Territory were foreign-born. By 1915, nearly 80% of North Dakotans were either immigrants or the children of immigrants. Not everyone welcomed the newcomers. The Immigration Restriction League was founded in Boston in 1894. The organization promoted legislation that would tighten regulations on immigration. The League objected to what they considered to be lower-class immigrants from Southern and Eastern Europe. In 1909, the National Association of American Manufacturers said they welcomed immigrants of a desirable quality. As the United States inched toward entering World War I, xenophobia reached new heights. Congress passed a bill restricting immigration, but President Wilson vetoed it. On this date in 1917, Congress overrode his veto and passed the bill. Americans were especially suspicious of Asian immigrants. The Immigration Act required a literacy test for immigrants. They also barred Asian immigrants, except for those from countries with special agreements with the United States, like the Philippines. North Dakota has always been attractive to newcomers. In 1890, 47% of North Dakotans were born outside the country. That was the highest percentage of immigrants in any state. A visit to old church graveyards is an eye-opener to just how crucial immigration has always been to North Dakota. Headstones with German, Norwegian, Russian, Swedish, and Ukrainian names are very common. Immigrants remain an integral part of North Dakota life. Immigrants make up 5% of the state's population and 13% of the agricultural workforce. Popular annual ethnic events like the Deuce of August, Sitten de Mai, and Norsk Hustfest continue to celebrate the immigrant heritage of the state. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Dr. Carol Butcher. I'm Errol Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
We'd like to thank the North Dakota Council on the Arts for supporting arts programming here on Prairie Public.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. The shooting death of Alex Preti in Minneapolis by federal authorities has sparked national outrage and a debate about the future of immigration enforcement, not to mention American democracy. But how are residents of the Twin Cities feeling, and what message do they have for the rest of the country? Join me and Minnesota Public Radio's Catherine Richard for a special town hall from Minnesota from NPR News and The Middle.
Don't miss this special town hall from The Middle, Friday at 3 p.m. Central, 2 Mountain on Prairie Public. Hey, did you miss it? Prairie Public's short and sweet drive? Well, it went by in a jiffy. It was only one day long after all, so you had to be pretty quick to get your truffle orders in. And if you did get yours in on Monday, thank you so much for powering Prairie Public. You know, listener donations like yours are just about the sole way this radio station and online service for North Dakota is funded. Your truffle order will be in the mailboxes of your choosing before Valentine's Day. Again, thank you. But hey, if you didn't get your donation in during Short and Sweet, there is still a little bit of time to make your Valentine or Valentines very happy. Just go to prairiepublic.org, set up your monthly donation, and tell us where to send those delicious cocoa truffles from the Kohl's fine pastry. But hurry, if you want February 14th to go well, you got to get your truffle order in by February 5th. That's Thursday.
And that's it for this Thursday's Main Street. We are deeply grateful that you've spent time with us. Remember, you can hear this and all past episodes of Main Street at our website at prairiepublic.org, or better yet, subscribe to it as a podcast. Remember, on the television service of Prairie Public at 8 p.m. tonight, it's John Harris's interview with Governor Kelly Armstrong. From all of us here at Prairie Public, we hope you have a great North Dakota weekend, and we look forward to seeing you again Monday right here on Main Street.